Hi, this is Bill Whalen, the host of Goodfellows. Thanks for listening to the audio version of the show, but we wanted to let you know that Goodfellows is primarily a video production, and you're missing a lot of extra features by only listening to our show. Give it a look by going to hoover.org/Goodfellows to see what you're missing. Thanks.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum. Which is what I am. Let's face it.
It's Wednesday, March 6, 2024, and welcome back to Goodfellows, a Hoover Institution broadcast examining social, economic, political, and geopolitical considerations. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a Hoover Distinguished Policy Fellow. I'll be your moderator today, joined by two of our three usual suspects. Neil Ferguson is not with us, but we are graced by the presence of the grumpy economist himself, John Cochran. And joining us all the way from Tokyo, ain't technology wonderful? I hate to think what time it is over in the Far East. Our resident optimist, former Presidential National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. Both John and H.R. are Hoover Senior Fellows. Well, we miss a Neil, we more than make up today with the presence of a Goodfellow fan's favorite, and that is the one and only Victor Davis Hanson. Victor is the Hoover Institution's Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow, his focus being classics and military history. You may already know Victor from his prolific writing, his many appearances on Fox News, or his podcast, The Victor Davis Hanson Show. He's also the author of numerous books, including 2019's The Case for Trump and 2021's The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. But wait, there's more. Somehow he's found the time to write yet another book. Victor has it coming out later this spring. The title of it is The End of Everything, How Wars Descended into Annihilation. You can pre-order it now on Amazon and help Mr. Bezos make even more money. Victor, welcome back to Goodfellows.
Thank you for having me, everyone.
I looked at a very important part of your biography, my friend, and that is the family business. You also run a family farm down in California's San Joaquin Valley. You trade in almonds. As I understand it, Victor, California is home to about 80% of the world's supply of almonds, but the almond business is not doing too well these days. And looking at the rain outside right now, it's not the weather. Is inflation the problem here?
Partly it was the stocks during COVID. So we went from 100,000 acres of almonds to 1.6 million in 20 years because of mechanization. So you can farm an acre of almonds for $2,000. And at $4.50 a pound for a while, it was $10,000 gross an acre. So big corporations overplanted. COVID came. There were supply chain stoppages. They only last about a year in storage. And India, China stopped buying or negotiating. The result of it is the price is $1.40. You need about $1.80 a pound to break even on most production. And they're going, I don't know if you've been along I-5, but they're tearing out thousands of acres of almond.
Well, fingers crossed, my friend, the industry bounces back. I'm glad to have you today, Victor. Your timing couldn't be any better because we're in a kind of interesting crossroads in 2024. Yesterday was Super Tuesday in America. For those who are not familiar with the intricacies of American presidential politics, Super Tuesday refers to about a dozen states across the country holding presidential primaries, a big night for Donald Trump and Joe Biden, who won almost every primary. I think Trump lost only in Vermont, and that was it. Joe Biden somehow managed to lose American Samoa with his 100 votes that were cast in that primary, but both are on their way to their nominations. Trump is about 80% of the way there in terms of delegates. Biden's about 70% of the way. And this morning, both lost their opponents. Former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley is suspending her campaign. She's dropping out. On the Democratic side, Congressman Dean Phillips ends his gadfly effort. He's dropped out, too. So now we're looking at a very historic election in America in this regard. It's the first time since 1956 that we're having a repeat election, the same two candidates running 4 years afterwards. It's the first time since 1912 that a former president will be on the November ballot, the first time since 1892 that the former president faces the man who vanquished him 4 years previously. One other way to look at this, Victor, it's now 243 days until November 5th, an American Election Day. Can you give us a survivor's guide of how to ride out the next 8 months?
Well, I don't think Joe Biden, I guess his State of the Union tomorrow night can mark his candidacy heating up, but I don't think it's going to heat up. He doesn't have the pretense of COVID this time around. So I know this sounds a little crazy. I think there's a genuine question whether he's viable to the convention. But at the convention, I feel that they're going to open up the delegates. And whether that means the Obama wing has control of the superdelegates or what. But it, I don't think that looks good because, as you know, Bill, in 72, 2 weeks after the convention, they had that last minute jetson of Senator Eagleton. 76, Reagan came on like gangbusters and disrupted, almost beat Gerry Ford. Gerry Ford was very upset. He kind of gave a lukewarm endorsement. And I think that led to Ford's problems in the fall. So I don't think it's going to be good for the Democrat. The final thing I'm saying is that I never thought that Donald Trump would pose as a voice of normalcy, but because of Biden's temper and his cognitive challenges and his radical agenda. I mean, it's way beyond Obama with an open border and the crime and wanting to ban internal combustion, the foreign policy. He's left a wide lane for Donald Trump to feign sober and judicious conduct and a conservative message that would be very appealing to a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't look at it.
So let's focus on that in the second segment of the show, Victor, because you wrote a very good column for American Greatness on how Trump can win this election. But John, let's talk about the State of the Union here. And let's don't get into the speech itself, because by the time most people are watching or listening to this, the speech will have gone down. Let's talk, though, about the speech in terms of three components that Biden is likely to address. The first one, my friend, is your wheelhouse, and it's economics. And it seems, John, that Bidenomics has given way to Liznomics, or Lizonomics, if you want to call it. Shrinkflation is the operative word coming out of this White House. They're going after evil corporations for gouging prices and putting too few cookies and crackers into boxes and stuff like that. John, I want your thoughts on both shrinkflation, but also what exactly the state of this economy is.
Well, I'm pleased that you're talking about policy, because I think this whole election is going to be a complete crazy ride. I think the State of the Union address will be the first one in which nobody's paying any attention to what's actually said, which is all written by a committee. But everybody's going to be playing amateur gerontologist to see just what the state of Biden's mental capacities is. And that'll be the news about it. But since you brought it up, there is a drumbeat of why are the little hoi-polloi so insufficiently grateful for all the wonders that Biden has done for them with Bidenomics. The current lines and the previews of the speech say they will talk a lot about inflation. Now, may inform our listeners, inflation is very simple. You print up $5 trillion worth of money, you hand it out, you get inflation. This has been known since the time of Emperor Diocletian. I hope I'll get my historical reference right there. And of course, what's been known historically is what you do next, which is you ignore that fact and you go on a witch hunt. And the witch hunt is for greedflation, shrinkflation, price gouging, monopoly, and all the rest of it. And our administration is on that witch hunt. I thought the most interesting one I saw is promotion of competition in agricultural markets. You'll be glad to see that, Victor. Of course, our government wants competition in agricultural markets, but also imposes price controls and import quotas. So the left hand and the right hand haven't quite agreed on that. Now, this is, I think, why is the message of shrinkflation and greedflation and Bidenomics failing? People aren't dumb. And this witch hunt has been going on for 2,000 years. Usually it's, you know, we go after the middlemen, the monopolists, the greed, and then the Jews, and they'll probably do that one too, as the way things are going. But it shows to the average American that these people don't know what they're doing, that they view it all entirely in terms of political spin, and maybe we can invent some price controls or drug price controls or something to blame it on the greedy monopolists and do something. But if you're an average almond grower, you understand where inflation comes from, and you don't think that more price controls or greedflation or shrinkflation out of the federal government is going to make it our business. So it shows them political, it shows them incompetent. If they, I mean, maybe they understand where inflation comes from and they're lying to us, or they don't understand where inflation comes from. And it shows that they disdain the intelligence of the average voter, which is, I think, why a lot of people are turning to Trump.
HR, let's turn to foreign policy now. I'd argue this is probably the most important foreign policy component of a State of the Union. last 20 years since probably the first term of Bush 43. I'd like you to do two things. First, let's talk about daylight between between Biden and Trump on the topic of Israel. And then let's get into Ukraine. And Victor, I want you to chime in, especially on Ukraine, because John and I are especially curious as to how this relates to that curious thing in Congress called NatCon. So first of all, HR, for the discerning voter who's trying to figure out policy difference between these two candidates, how do they differ on Israel?
Well, I think it's Israel in context. I think what the disaster of the Biden administration is on foreign policy, I mean, there are many of them, but you have to trace it back to the humiliating withdrawal and surrender mm-hmm. to a terrorist organization that just be fair, occurred across both administrations, the Trump administration with this agreement in February of 2020, but the Biden administration is saying, well, we couldn't change that. Well, they could change every other Trump policy, including opening the borders and so forth. So here's what I think is, I think weakness is provocative. And the Biden administration has been very effective at projecting weakness. I think there's a direct line between the withdrawal and surrender and humiliation in Afghanistan to the reinvasion of Ukraine. Mm. And then across all of this time, you have the supplication to the Iranians by the Biden administration in an effort to resurrect the already dead Iran nuclear deal under the same assumption that drove Obama policy, which was the belief that Iran, if they're welcomed back in, if the supreme leader is welcomed back into the international community, that he'll change his behavior. And in fact, they were actually organizing an effort to cede power to Iran in the region as a balance against some of our friends and partners in the region, including the Emiratis and the Saudis. This created the perception of profound weakness, as well as the difficult relationship between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, there are other sources of perception of weakness as well, internal to Israel, with the judicial reform movement and the opposition to it. But the supreme leader essentially said, hey, I want to cross this off my bucket list, destroy Israel. And he activated the Ring of Fire strategy initiated on October 7th. And of course, this isn't the only action that's been taken against Israel. There have been, prior to that, continuing attacks from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, various acts of violence in the West Bank that are continuing, and also the threat of Iran assembling a proxy army on the border of Israel across the Golan in Syria. It's extended, obviously, across the region now with the Houthis involved and the mobilization of various Iranian militias in the region. Where did this come from? It came from the perception of weakness. The question is, if you compare that Biden approach, disastrous approach to the Middle East, with President Trump, the question is, what President Trump are we going to get? Are we going to get the President Trump who understood that he had to force a choice in Iran? Hey, either choose to be part of the international community, or we're going to isolate you financially and economically. And we're going to stand up to you militarily, which was, of course, typified and most dramatically with the killing of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas in Baghdad. But what did he do after that? He kind of took counsel of his fears. He backed off. He didn't respond to a number of acts of Iranian aggression, I think about 100 of them, against acts of war, I would say, against U.S. personnel and facilities, including the shoot down of a drone from Iranian soil. So, I think what cuts across both administrations is this perception of weakness vis-a-vis Iran is what has provoked Iran, because, we don't act like we know what the return address is. I think if you get the President Trump of 2017 and 18 and into 19, you have a fundamental shift in policy in the Middle East to our benefit that strengthens Israel's defense in what was already going to be a multi-year war. We are in a multi-year war in the Middle East already. And I'm waiting to hear, what are President Biden's, what is he going to say about that? And what interests are at stake and what our actions should be and how we should bring others. And what is President Trump, candidate Trump, going to say about that?
Well, I agree with almost all of what HR said. There is a rivalry or a schism among the MAGA people between what I would call Taft isolationist and what I would call Jacksonians, no better friend, no punitive people, the people who advised him to take out Soleimani, to bomb ISIS back to the Stone Age, to declare the Houthis a terrorist organization, to cut off Hamas from, move the embassy, give the Golan Heights. All of that was very good. And I think there's a war for the hearts and minds of the Trump people between those two groups. And that it goes to Ukraine, where there's a difference between traditional Republicans in the Congress, some of them, and Trump is, that schism exists from Ukraine, but I don't think Trump is going to cut Ukraine off. I don't think he's an isolationist in that fashion. But I don't think, because he's so sensitive to the interventionist, optional, endless war narrative, that he's going to give Ukraine the wherewithal under the auspices of strategic necessity that would be necessary to defeat Russia. And that would be the wherewithal to attack targets within Russia, which would have to be done if you're going to stop it. I don't think he's going to do that. He'll probably continue the aid, but call it a loan or something, some gimmick like that. But I want to say one other thing very quickly. There is a very big asset, and I'm speaking to someone that supports giving Ukraine money and defense to defend its territorial integrity, but there's a big difference the way that people look at Ukraine and Israel. I mean, no one is calling for a ceasefire in Ukraine. Nobody says to Zelensky, as they do to Netanyahu, you have to have a ceasefire. No one tells Zelensky, when you shoot off a HIMARS rocket, you better text people or you better drop leaflets to avoid a collateral damage. No one is telling Zelensky, as they told Netanyahu, you better have a wartime government that has a bipartisan consensus, a wartime cabinet with the opposition. Zelensky canceled elections. He canceled political parties. He suspended habeas corpus in a lot of Ukraine. And I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying that nobody is saying to Zelensky, you've got to be proportionate. That's insanity for anybody to fight a war proportionally. It ends up like the Hundred Years' War or Vietnam. So I don't know why that difference there. I have my suspicions, but there's no consistency on the way that a lot of people on the left and the right put pressure on Israel in about 8 key areas. They wouldn't dare say that to Ukraine. I'll just finish with Ukraine. I'm a little worried because I think the people I've talked to suggest there may be now, August, they said there were 600,000 combined dead and wounded, and now we're hearing totals of 700. If it continues in this deadlock, we'll probably have 1 million pretty soon. We had a 10-month war in Verdun from February 1916 to December, and the total German and French dead was 700,000 wounded, dead, French and German. And when the battle ended, it was heroic, they shall not pass, and all that. A heroic French defense, great. It saved the Western Front, but they ended up right where they were when they started. And no one is talking about that. The population of Ukraine has gone from 44 million probably to 35 million. They say it'll get down to 30 million. And I don't know. I don't know if we have a creative solution that allows some type of cessation without rewarding Putin. And what Zelensky and Putin talked to in February of March of 2022, I don't think is still viable. But you hear people say it was never the position of Obama, Trump, Biden to get back Crimea and Donbass before the war. Zelensky said he couldn't do it. Is there a possibility that you institutionalize what was never going to go back for the last 10 years, Crimea and the Donbass, and then you force Putin to go back to where he was in February of 2020? You don't put Ukraine in NATO, but you arm it to the teeth so that it would be stupid to try it again. I don't know if that's what I hear. That's the only possible way to stop the carnage, unless you go full bore. And that's, you know, you hear they need 1,000 Abrams tanks, they need 150 F-16, and you want to get into a real what would, we're not doing what's necessary to win, if that's right. What we're doing, but we're doing what's necessary to keep the killing going for a long time. So I suggest if you want to win, you have to give them more. And if you want to stop the killing, you have to find some kind of an agreement. And the question is, an armistice that doesn't leave a winner or loser, is that bad than a continued deadlock that kills 1 million people? And I don't have the answer for that.
So two questions for you. First, HR, you hear Republican senators now uttering the phrase, time for a negotiated settlement. That would seem to be an opportunity to make the argument for arms, because the idea of a negotiated settlement is you want to give Zelensky as much leverage as he can have against Putin, so send him more weapons. But Victor, you suggest that Trump, at the end of the day, will be in favor of more aid to Ukraine. What happens, though, when he comes out and says, I'm in favor of more aid, send their weapons? What do Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and that rump little group of House Republicans who seem opposed to this, will they go along with him, or they just generally want to pound sand against anyone who wants to tell them what to do?
That depends on the election. If Donald Trump wins 50 seats in the House or 40 seats and takes the Senate, Matt Gaetz will nod and say that there's no daylight between him and Trump, no matter what he does. But if he doesn't, then yeah, they have problems. I don't think that Trump is going to give them the weapons that would do what a classical military strategist or HR would think that would be necessary to win. And that would be to a lot more damage to the Russian military, because Trump, everybody discounts all of these threats that Putin makes and all these crazy people in the Russian parliament. But at some point, if they feel they are going to, I don't think they're going to allow themselves to be expelled from Ukraine without a serious, crazy retaliation. And I don't think we would in 1962 when Cuba, all of a sudden, our little protectorate, mafia run, 1959, we get a communist dictatorship. 3 years later, we get missiles pointed at us, and we just arbitrarily tell the Khrushchev Soviets, we're not going to allow that, period. And we went to DEFCON 4.
No one's about putting nuclear missiles in Ukraine.
Victor, I disagree with you on this. I think the party that has the most to fear from escalation is Putin. And I think the reason why Putin has made these recent threats, to escalate vertically again, is again because of this perception of weakness. The divisions that he's seen that have prevented us, from providing sustained support to the Ukrainians.
From the Americans or the Europeans?
From the Americans.
Yeah. I think the Europeans have had it.
Well, the Europeans are stepping up, actually, and have provided significant economic assistance, the $60 billion bill or so that passed on the European Union recently. So I think that, that if the perception of weakness is what makes Putin threaten more, but if escalation would demonstrate how weak he is, we have to remember, an ex-hot dog salesman, an ex-con, marched on Moscow, shot down, I think 6 or 7 aircraft. They were cratering the roads on the way to Moscow.
I know, but we were told the spring offensive, it went on for 6 months. And I never understood the logic of a country that has 30 million people versus 144 trying to do a Guderian or Patton breakthrough with that Maginot line
I think we're talking about two separate things here. In terms of Ukraine, it's obviously their capability times their will. I think, and you're right to raise this concern about Ukrainian capacity, right? I think the demographic or the statistic that is relevant is the number of military age people who are willing to serve in combat in both Russia and in Ukraine. And to use the 1916 analogy, I think the Russians could be on the brink of something akin to the French army mutiny in World War I, where they broke themselves in the effort to penetrate the defenses in Verdun and elsewhere. And I think what happened with Ukraine is you had the equivalent kind of the Nivelle offensive, where they thought they had the solution. This was Nivelle's term. Remember, I have the solution. Well, he didn't have the solution. And he impaled the French army on Germany's defenses, took losses until the army mutinied. And this is when Pétain came in. Before he became a turncoat, he was an effective general officer. And so when we talk about the stalemate of the war, this is a temporary condition. And of course, there's situations can change quite dramatically. In terms of the peace idea, the idea that there can be a ceasefire that cedes a portion of Ukraine's territory, Crimea and portions of the East to Russia, I just don't think it's feasible because Putin won't stop. Right, Putin, even if he were to agree to something like he agreed to the Minsk agreement, he'll just break it and continue to try to choke Ukraine out. And of course, the Ukrainians. We're talking about tens of thousands of Ukrainian children who have been kidnapped. We're talking about mass murder of the Ukrainian people, mass rapes, war crimes
unimaginable. I understand all that. I just wonder if Ukraine is going to be stronger now or it's going to be stronger in a year from now, because its population is declining radically. And when you talk to Ukrainian people about it, they say the problem is not the weapons, it's they're running out of people. And that was that's the Russian strategy. And I just don't know what is necessary for this diminishing manpower pool. And this is why people like crazy Macron say that there might be, you know, troops there. But what is necessary strategically, tactically to defeat the Roman army? I mean, Russian army. What is it?
Let me add it here, too.
Because I don't know, HR, what would be necessary? And I don't mean that sarcastic, here's sincerely.
The Ukrainians are not trying to invade Russia and take Moscow. So the analogy is they're just trying to take back small parts of their own country.
Yes, but they haven't been able to do it for 10 years. But not since 2014.
When you're adding up who has population and so forth, and the objective of the Ukrainians is not to roll tanks to Moscow.
But what is the objective? Is it to get back to February?
Crimea. Crimea
back
is
to before 2000, before 2014.
Yeah, which we said we respect these. We promised your territorial integrity in terms of if you got.
But there was a reason they didn't do that in 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19.
You're saying they're running out of people. They're running out of people because they don't have weapons. A modern combined arms offensive would not be this horrendous meat grinder. And it is the fact that we're not letting them have the proper weapons to do it that is causing this amazing loss of life in Ukraine. So properly done, this would not be a meat grinder. And there are actually a lot of draft age men left in Ukraine. So with the proper weapons and the will to do it, I disagree that this is just...
I remember a year ago, very quickly at our military history, and I have the utmost respect for Peter Mansour, and he was very sincere. So people said, what do they need to make the spring offensive work? And he said, they need 1,000 Abrams tanks and they need 150 F-16s. And then he went on and everybody had their jaw open and said, oh my God, that's larger than many of the European military. I said, exactly. And where you get the political support for that? And is that what I'd like to hear from HR just very briefly? And I don't mean this sarcastically, I mean it sincerely. What do you think they would need and could do to get the Russian army out of where they were prior to 2014?
There are two fundamental military objectives. The first is to provide for the Ukrainians to be able to stop the onslaught, right? To prevent Russia from gaining additional territory, but also to stop the Russians from continuing the attacks against Ukrainian infrastructure, against Ukrainian civilians, and so forth. And that's a range of capabilities that we could actually quite easily provide, Victor.
What would that be? Providing. So more HIMARS or things like that?
Well, there's tiered and layered air defense capabilities, certainly some of which are relatively inexpensive because they're oriented on point areas or bounded geographic areas like port facilities, for example. And then there's the long range precision fires, which you've heard much debated, like you've heard the Biden administration debate every single capability that went to the Ukrainians, right? Should we provide them with more javelins? Oh, gosh, I don't know. Hand-wringing. Should we provide them with mobile protected firepower, you know, tanks and Bradleys, hand-wringing? Should we provide them with additional air defense capabilities, but beyond the short-range air defense capabilities? Should we provide them with long-range fires and artillery, and how much? And so one of the reasons we're at the point at which we are is that people kind of ignored the laws of physics, you know, in terms of how long it takes to get capabilities there, and then what it takes to integrate those capabilities into combined arms units that can conduct really what is the most difficult task in combat, which is to sustain a penetration and an offensive through a tiered and defense in depth, which is what the Russians were able to prepare. You know, this is what Karl von Clausewitz observed about war. It's still true that the offensive is the decisive form of war, but the defensive is the strongest form of war. So at the very least, you know, we can bolster Ukraine's defenses now and help them build the capacity at some point in the future to conduct a counteroffensive. Clausewitz also said that the counterattack, what he called the flashing sword of vengeance, is the best moment for the defense. Right now, the Russians are impaling themselves on Ukrainian defenses. Now, sadly, Ukrainians are constrained in terms of the amount of ammunition that they can use. This is around Avdiivka and so forth. But the Russians have taken the highest number of casualties per day in these recent offenses. I don't think it's sustainable, Victor. You know, I hear from people, hey, you know, the Russians are tough. The Russians are used to it. But, you know what their motivation is? Their motivation is a GRU or SVR guy behind them with a pistol is going to shoot them in the head.
I know.
So,
I'm worried because we were told that the sanctions would strangle Russia, the oil. Yeah. And what's worrisome now is that while this is going on, we're creating this next. I know everybody talks about it, but we've got China, Russia, we got Iran supplying weapons. We've got the Southern Hemisphere almost in lockstep, not with us. We've got places like Vietnam that are hosting Russian people coming over. We have the Middle East people. And India even is triangulating. And it doesn't seem that we are projecting the idea that Ukraine is winning, Russia's on the losing side, and you should join the winners. It seems like the opposite is true.
I think that's HR's point.
So here, I've got to quickly
win this thing before everybody joins the other side.
So how do you reverse this impression?
This is all related to our inability to sustain support to Ukraine. So I'm in Tokyo, Japan right now. And what I'm hearing is that, you know, if the United States doesn't support Ukraine, your influence here is going to be vastly diminished. And so one of the reasons why you see this kind of hedging activity, you know, engaging the Russians and the Chinese, is because we are not viewed as reliable. And this has to do at the moment with the ability to sustain support for Ukraine. But it also has to do, again, to go back to the surrender. The self-defeat is what it really was with the Taliban. So if America is going to surrender, you know, to a terrorist organization, how can they be the reliable partner in any of these other contests? India, you mentioned India. India looks over its shoulder. They have Chinese soldiers bludgeoning Indian soldiers to death on the Himalayan frontier. Does America have our back in South Asia? No, they left South Asia. They left Afghanistan. Who is the only power they can hedge with when they have two hostile nuclear countries on the border? It's Russia, right? So our lack of resolve, Victor, you know, our willingness
that transcends. You know, and I've been a big critic. I mean, the Chinese, all these things were incremental. The Chinese balloon, the way we courted Iran, the Afghanistan debacle, it all created this picture that convinced Putin, you know, saying that we wouldn't react if it was a minor invasion. I agree with you entirely. We invited him in, and we're now into this. We've given Ukraine enough stuff so they can survive, but not enough so they can win. And we've got
to change that.
We have to
call time on the rights and wrongs of it, and think of the politics of it, which is where we started. Clearly, it sounds like Trump and the congressional Republicans aren't going to do it either. So we're kind of in a hopeless mess here.
And Victor, just to make a couple points, you know, I think you're right about, you know, how we should be concerned about this war going on, right? It's a costly war. But, you know, I think that the cost of surrender, which I think any kind of a ceasefire at this stage that we would try to impose on the Ukrainians by constraining our support to them, would be much higher than the continuation of the war. The Ukrainians would, I think, agree with that. So I think what's important to recognize is that, you know, wars do not remain static in perpetuity. As you know, World War I ended as a war of maneuver. And so I think it's easy to imagine, you know, that Russia not being able to sustain this effort. They've impaled themselves on Ukrainian defenses. And, you know, Vladimir Putin doesn't look very strong to me right now, Victor. And we could, you know, talk more about this with some of our colleagues, Stephen Kocken and others. But, you know, I think that the murder of Navalny, and then, you know, they're arresting people for laying flowers, you know.
I mean,
they still have more people in their internal security services.
But what you just said is what I'm saying is, and John brought it up, the political ramifications. That argument has not resonated. So when you look at the polls, there are people who don't want to, I think the majority do not want to cut off Ukraine, but they do not want to fund the necessary wherewithal, because that argument has not been made. And
well,
it's,
Victor, this is such an important point. You're so right. So, but you know, who should make that argument? The president. And you remember when Zelensky visited, do you remember that statement that they made? I think it was in the East Room. It was disastrous, not only because the president didn't make the case in a coherent manner, but he turned it immediately into a partisan issue. He used the opportunity to bludgeon the Republicans instead of saying, this is why all Americans. So remember, he was supposed to be the unifier, right? And he's not, this is something we should all be able to get behind. And he's not making the case effective. He's not.
Well, let me ask a question of Victor, because you're our representative from Trump land and so forth.
I have differences with all candidates.
No, I know you do.
You keep saying that I'm a rubber stamp for Trump.
No, I don't mean that.
No. You understand it. I think you understand it. You understand the movement very well.
You understand them better. So there is this isolationist movement. Do they not want to support Ukraine because they think we shouldn't, or because they worry they're all for America, but they worry that it will be executed incompetently and that we don't have the state?
No, the reason is they look at this Biden administration and they feel that the citizen is second. In other words, they're running up this $36 trillion deficit and they're flying illegal aliens all over the country, or they're giving them in here, California, free healthcare. They're giving them 10,000. They're doing everything that they don't do for citizens. They look at the military and they say, okay, that was what the House Republicans who really wanted to give something. Most of them wanted to give aid to Ukraine, but politically they had to say, well, let's fix the first border first. That would be very easy. It didn't require any money. It didn't require any new legislation. All they had to do was go back to the 90 executive orders that he got rid of and just and they could have stopped it. They could do it in a week. Instead, they cooked up this idea, we'll let in 5,000 before we have a threshold and we're going to do all. They didn't need to do any of that. So their attitude is, every time a serious crisis comes up in the United States, our budget, 100,000 fentanyl deaths, 100,000 fentanyl deaths, we don't solve the problem. And then when you try to explain to them, this is a very serious problem with Russia and China, this new axis that will affect your security, to them, that is abstract. What's concrete is we're going broke. We have an open border. We don't care about citizens. We put them second. And that Ukrainian feeds into that. And so if you're going to support Ukraine, I think it would be wise to say, I support Ukraine. I want the border closed now. We don't need any new laws, no new money, just follow the law. And they could do it. And I think that's why I think Donald Trump, I have a lot more confidence in him than Biden, because he understands that. He will close the border on day one. And that will give a lot of leverage for him to have a kind of a Jacksonian, I want to protect Americans and I want to stop threats to our national security. He is a Jacksonian. He did it until, I think HR's right, the wishy-washy, we'll leave 3,500 troops in Afghanistan. It left it open to what Biden did. But otherwise, I thought, I mean, what do you object to? We got out of the Iran was neutered when Biden came in, and Hamas was neutered, and Putin was neutered. And so nobody wanted to screw around with us. I didn't think.
I would say, Victor, I agree with like 90% of that. I do think what he did is he listened to some people who wanted him to actually replicate the Obama approach to the Middle East, right? The pivot out of the Middle East. And so, you know, the problem is President Trump has this kind of dissonance about him, right? He understands the importance of defeating jihadist terrorists like Hamas, right? And you know, I've seen him so incensed, you know, when remember the Manchester bomb, the Manchester terrorist attack, for example. You know, he was so angry about that, you know, and then he turned that into real progress on constraining terrorist financing, on going after jihadist terrorist groups more effectively from a multinational perspective, enlisting the Saudis in the effort to separate, you know, to isolate these terrorist organizations from ideological support, you know, the effort to isolate them financially and so forth. So, you know, that's all positive. But then he also had this impulse to just disengage from the Middle East. You know, he would say, hey, it's just a mishmash of crap, you know, in the Middle East. And he listened to people who I think who didn't maybe fully understand that if you think that problems in the Middle East can be contained there, you're wrong. We're seeing that now, obviously. And then just when you think things can't get worse in the Middle East, they actually can. And the U.S. disengagement from the region is not the answer. We're not going to solve that region's problems. No way in hell. Mm-hmm. But our disengagement from it in the last couple of years of the Trump administration, I think, did embolden Iran, you know, who got back up off the mat, you know, after the Soleimani strike. So I guess the question is, Victor, you know, what Donald Trump do we get? What should we be listening for? You know, you've just revived.
I know we have to have Bill, but I would just say that I talked to a very high Israeli official, and he wrote out 12 things that he said he would never get, ever. No Israeli would ever get them. Something like the Abrams Accord, cutting off Hamas, get out of the Iran deal, declare the Houthis, side with them against Hezbollah on natural gas stuff, Golan Heights, move the... And for the first time in history, they got all of them, and at great political cost to him. And so what I'm saying is that you can say that the last year, but if you take that four-year regnum and you compare it with the last 50 years, there has been no stronger advocate of Israel who went out on a limb. And
I agree with that.
I would add to that, Victor,
the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, the Abraham Accords.
Yes.
And I would add the cutoff of the support to UNRWA, right? This organization. Yes,
absolutely. Which 700 million. Million.
And you know who was in the forefront of that, too, sadly, was Nikki Haley was in the forefront of that. That was really her initiative. So,
I know.
But you know, so I agree with you. And, you know, Victor, we worked with the Israelis very closely, I think in a way that was unprecedented, to mobilize our relative advantages against Iran's threat network in the region. And all of that dissipated under the Biden administration.
No, so it did.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I do think at the end, you know, he had these Iago figures in his ear all the time, you know, who I think
they were very worried about getting reelected, unfortunately, in COVID. And the same argument you're making is applicable to why did he keep Fauci and Birx against the advice of people like Jay and Scott on the quarantine. It was the same thing. Anyway, I'm sorry, Bill.
Bill, I'm gonna ask Victor one more question, because Victor, we were talking the other day. You know, you're a superstar, Victor. You know, every time I go anywhere, they're like, "Do you know Victor Davis Hanson?" I'm gonna say, "Hey, man, my office is next to him."
That can be bad.
It gives me a lot of cred.
People ask me about you guys all the time.
So, Victor, you know, Victor's revised your book. You have a new edition coming out. Could you maybe explain that effort? And then what changed? How do you think, you know, those who support him, how that has that movement evolved, and how has he evolved? What are the if you could just preview the changes?
There's two things. I wrote a 14,000 word introduction that comes out in August. He's been the beneficiary. First of all, you got to start with, he didn't do anything. He did stuff, but before you get to that, very quickly. No, but Joe Biden was good old Joe Biden from Scranton. That was the supposedly moderate veneer for this Jacobin agenda that blew up, and he's got historic lows. He's got corruption problems. He's got cognitive problems. He's down at 33% in some polls, and every one of these issues is polling, and Bill knows better than I do, below 40%, 50% below. And so people are looking, believe it or not, they look at Trump and they see all of this outburst of Biden and get off the grass kind of dementia.
It's Trump nostalgia, Victor.
Yes. And they're looking at Trump. And I never thought this, but this is the most remarkable political comeback since Richard Nixon in 62. He comes off as the return to normalcy. And if he can do that and say, you guys want the border? Of course you do. You want an end of crime? Yeah. You want deterrence abroad? I'm the normal guy. This guy was the revolutionary, and he's mean, and he's angry, and he yells, and he can discipline himself like he did after the Iowa.
Okay, Victor, let me push back.
New Hampshire. He can win.
Let me push back, Victor, because Trump's going to be spending a lot of time between now and the next 243 days in and out of courts. Yes. And this is not like going to traffic court. He's going to be in courts in New York where they're questioning his marital fidelity, having just questioned his fiscal manhood. He's going to be in courts in Georgia and Washington, D.C., where they're basically questioning his patriotism. This is lawfare, which I know John wants to talk about. We'll get into that. So here's a question. First of all, you mentioned polling, Victor. There was a very fascinating New York Times Siena poll over the weekend. Biden's at 39% positive and about 54% negative. He's 15 points underwater. Trump's approval is 5 points better, 44. And the numbers are devastating when you ask Americans just what has Biden done for me or his policies working with me. It's a hell scenario for him. But here's the question, Victor. Trump is going to be going into court in very personal ways. And this is kind of lawfare. And John and I think disagree on lawfare, by the way. I think it's been a very smart strategy in at least two regards. While John will say it's failed in terms of kicking him off the ballot, I'll say it's done two things. One, Victor, it cleared the Republican field. Before lawfare kicked in, DeSantis had a pretty good shot at taking it down.
Did.
Trump was struggling. And then that ended. And then secondly, it really gets under Trump's skin. It deranges him. So this is my question, Victor. You're absolutely right. If he can stay on the high road, if he can stay on the message as he was at the end of 2016, yeah, he's got a shot. But when he's going in and out of court constantly and he's being just screwed with on a very personal basis, he's going to go ape. So how do you think he's going to be? How are you going to get good Trump when this could be very tempting on almost a daily basis to be bad Trump?
And you're right about that. That's a temptation. And they're trying to obviously bankrupt him and destroy his mental and physical health. But if you look at the five cases very carefully, and the public are aware of them. The Fannie Willis case is blowing up. They had this testimony today. They're going to move that. They're going to be disbarred, all three of them. And they're going to move that case to a different jurisdiction that will drop it. Jack Smith may or may not win, but he's got two problems. One is he's got the president of the United States who removed classified files to four locations over 30 years and who in 2017 admitted on tape that he had classified files in his possession and he didn't come forward for 6 years. And yet it's going to be very hard to prosecute the leading contender when the president has got more exposure in Biden. The insurrection, I don't think that's going to go anywhere. If you look at Letitia James, if that is not reversed on appeal, you don't have a country. They charge him with a crime that had never been charged about anybody else. It was a consumer fraud bill. And then
they passed a law, Victor. Right. They passed a law to suspend the statute of limitations.
I know. That was on Gene Carroll.
So they
that
could prosecute one person.
Yeah, that was a bill of attainder on Jean Carroll. It was all done. She had no chance. A New York legislature passed a bill saying that for 1 year only, you could suspend the statute of limitations on sexual assault. And then there was no jury in the Judge Kaplan case with Jean Carroll. There was no jury in the Letitia James. Alvin Bragg has taken a federal offense, supposedly a campaign finance violation with a non-disclosure form and turned it in somehow to a state offense. So I think there's a 50-50 chance that all of them will be reversed or they're going to dissipate. But even if they aren't, John's got a good point. They continue to give empathy because they're not just neutral. They're so outrageous that everybody who hates Trump says that still is outrageous. The other thing about his money, you're right that he's got $400 million in cash and he owes $500 million with penalties and legal fees. And he's going to have another $500 million all total. But if this Truth Social goes through, I don't know how much stock he can sell before the price collapses, but it could be a $5 or $6 billion deal. He might be able to get another $100 billion or $50 billion or something. Who knows? But my point, I mean million, not billion, but my point is that compared to the Democrats' problem with a non-compos mentis candidate that they have to get rid of at the convention with a black woman as the vice president, and given the history of what happens when you screw around the convention, it seems to me that in a comparative sense, for the first time in a long time, he's in the driver's seat vis-a-vis Biden, and he wasn't before. And DeSantis, you're absolutely right. DeSantis was 4 points ahead of him until these lawfare things started. He's got a lot better people around him too, Bill.
Victor, tell me how the Democrats could cleanly remove Joe Biden, because the fact is Kamala Harris will not go gently into that good night.
No.
And you have at least four or five Democratic governors who will take their own delegations who want to get in. It'll be a mess. It'll be just, and I know there's people like those are fine who talk about
it. It's in Chicago, too.
Yeah, I think it'll be a 19th century convention where I don't know the role of the superdelegates or who controls them, but there will be, they're going to have to release the delegates and they're going to have to vote. And then they're going to have to say, a proud Black woman, we wanted her to win, but she didn't get enough delegates. And therefore,
Let's wrap up the segment on this question, Victor. So that convention scenario begs the question of who controls the Democratic Party. Does someone like Barack Obama hold sway? Is it labor unions? Is it the sitting president? But conversely, on the Republican side, I was going to ask you if Donald Trump should have given the response to the State of the Union just because the Republican Party. Who represents the Republican Party? Is it now the nominee in waiting or Republicans still searching for a leader?
Yeah, well, it's going to be the Republican nominee in waiting. And Nikki Haley can say all she wants, but she will endorse him. She has two choices. If she does not endorse him and he wins, she's out. If she does not endorse him and lose, she's blamed. If she endorses him and he loses, she's still viable in 2028. If she endorses him and he wins, she's in a good position. So that's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer, and she'll make that decision after her pride is assuaged, and maybe in another month or two. So he's the head of the party there. The people who are controlling the Democratic Party are the Obama team, the Obama appointments that are in the Biden administration, and the people like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or the Squad. It's the hard left. And Obama's the most prominent person there. And they communicate. And they made a Faustian bargain that they got a moderate veneer to push down the hardest left agenda in a generation or two. And that's not, it's falling apart because they calculated wrong. They thought Joe Biden would be viable for 4 years, and he's not.
I just want to add that that's right, because I read a very interesting thing actually in the New York Times. Everyone underestimates Trump because of his personality and the Twitter and all the craziness surrounding him. Trump, this is an amazing political comeback, and Trump has turned out to be an amazing politician. What the Times wrote, with of course how terrible this was, how he went and got every single Republican to endorse him. Now, that's the sort of thing politicians do, but basically every member of Congress.
When you talk to the people around him,
he is in charge of the Republican Party in the way a traditional politician puts himself in charge of a party. And that's a fact.
You're absolutely right. When you talk to him, Bill, you end up talking to people around him like Devin Nunes or Robert O'Brien or people like the Scaramucci's, Omarosso, Steve Bannon. They're not here this time. And they've got the Heritage Foundation got a contract with America. They're going through 20,000 potential appointees. So I think that he's learned his lesson. But I mean, Trump is Trump, and he's capable of saying anything, anywhere, anytime to anyone. But I think he knows now that given the Biden radicalism, he has an avenue to be the restorer of civilization or normality. And he's got people around him who are telling him that every moment, every moment.
HR, you get the last word, and here it is, 243 more days of this. Are you thinking about Tokyo long-term? Can you paddleboard in Tokyo Bay?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it is regrettable that we wound up, I think, with choices that the vast majority of Americans would rather not have to make, right? This is, you know, it's a rematch, but this is not the thrill in Manila. You know, this is not Ali Frazier, you know, by any means. And so I guess what is the best we can do? I just wonder, you know, which Donald Trump shows up on each day. I mean, it's quite clear that Donald Trump does prioritize what's best for Donald Trump. When that prioritization aligns with the interests of the country, that's really great. You know, and he can make great decisions. He can make tough decisions, but oftentimes he can't stick with those decisions. And the way that he is most easily manipulated, and this is not a flash or news flash or anything, is that people tell him, hey, this will look weak to your base. This is going to alienate your base. And he's so easy to play that way that prevents him from getting to the politics of addition to bring more people in to a coalition. Agree. He just doubles down. You know, and
I wrote that column on Monday, that very column. Yeah, I agree 100% with you. And like, he's got to expand. He needs 5 to 7%, 3 to 7 of independents, Reagan, old Reagan, whatever you call him, Perot. He needs suburbanites. He needs another 3 or 5%.
And he's got to do it by unifying. He's got to call up Haley and say, bygones are bygones. This is, I'll give you 2 months, endorse the, and we'll bring up, you know, he's got to do that. He's got to do it all across the board. He knows that.
Stop,
I think.
Stop. Get rid of words like retribution. You know, I mean, it's not.
And, well, he did the other day. I mean, he said, my retribution is success. He didn't say, you know. Yeah. So I think there's people around him that are telling him that message nonstop. But we're dealing with a person who, we've never had this in America. Take a guy off the bat, try to take the leading candidate off the ballot, go into five different criminal and civil suits to destroy his, outlaw his business. We've never seen anything like this.
And
this goes way beyond.
That's the only beginning. I'm still doom and gloom about the lawfare situation. Every part of this election is going to be in the court. Every court decision is going to be protested. The House, if the House goes Republicans, they are going to not certify it because he's an insurrectionist.
It's going to be something that we've never seen before. It's going to be the nastiest, and there's going to be more money to spend against Donald Trump than we've ever seen. And so I understand.
So Victor, can I bring in your training as a classicist here?
Yes.
Can we get Trump to take counsel from the Stoic philosophers? Can he just focus on what he can control instead of, you know, getting distracted all the time and being his own worst enemy? I mean, what do you think the prospects are of that?
I think he can mitigate that. But the reason that he got where he is that he was unpredictable and fiery, and that, and he conveyed a certain common man that I'm speaking for. So yeah, you're right. He is a captive of his base, but he can be very funny. I mean, tragically, his brother died of alcoholism. They ask him, why didn't you drink? And he said, can you imagine what I would be like if I drank? You know, it was stuff like that he does. So we all appeal to the better angels of his. He has great abilities, but he has this tendency to get angry and self-destruct. And you know, that we've got leaders like it. But remember one thing. I think everybody, if we just ignore the media, there has been an effort to use the FBI to hire out social media, to forge a document in a FISA court, to lie under oath. And when you have people like James Comey or John Brennan or James Clapper lying under oath repeatedly, it's the weaponization of the institutions on the left on the idea of, we're going to change the filibuster, the Electoral College, bring in new states. We're going to do all of these things because our noble ends justify any means necessary. So we're in a cultural political revolution almost, and it's directed at him.
Also, though, of course, you know, he directed an attack on our own institutions as well, right? So it's just like the worst of all worlds. I mean,
it was rhetorical. But the funny thing
and
is,
it was not from within.
Yeah, he didn't. The FBI didn't, under Trump, go after individual people. The FBI, you didn't get, Donald Trump didn't call up 51 former CIA officers and say, I want you to lie right before the debate, and you got to say this is true. He didn't do that. He appointed a special counsel, and the special counsel, Robert Mueller, was no merit. I mean, it was different.
Gentlemen, on to the lightning round.
What is the lightning round?
We're supposed to be succinct, but we struggle with that.
Okay. Is it just to stick a statement or questions or what?
Where we answer
just
questions really yes. quickly.
Okay.
All right. For this week's lightning round, we have a question. We're going to actually start with a column written recently by David Frum in The Atlantic, who argues that it's time to uncancel Woodrow Wilson, the American president and former president of Princeton University, whose name was taken off a building for his rather, shall we say, unenlightened views on race. Here's what Frum writes, and I want your guys' comments on this. It is above all to the drumbeat of Wilsonian idealism that American foreign policy has marched since his watershed presidency and continues to march to this day. Mr. Frum adds, I very much believe that the United States has been a force for good in the world in the 20th and 21st centuries. If you do also, then our appreciation must begin with the fundamental achievement of the president who first exerted this force. Gentlemen, yes or no, is it time to uncancel Woodrow Wilson? Victor?
I'm not a big fan of Woodrow Wilson, so I think he got his just desserts. I don't believe in canceling anybody, but if they're going to cancel somebody, I don't I don't shed any tears over his cancellation.
John?
Double cancel him. He was the great, he brought about the progressive state. He vastly expanded the government, and his idealism turned out we solved all those problems in the Treaty of Versailles, and the Germans never came to bother us again. That one worked out beautifully, didn't it? So I'm for double canceling him for additional reasons, additional charges.
Okay. HR?
I'll just point out that he was not in his right mind at the end of his presidency, and his wife pretty much ran the show in the White House. Not that there's any relevance to today or anything.
Yes.
Okay, next question for the gentleman. The Oscar ceremony is this weekend, so let's go to the movies. The actor-activist Rob Reiner, Victor's a big fan of his work and his beliefs. He recently said that, quote, the greatest single performance in U.S. cinema belongs to Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront. Do you guys believe, or is Mr. Reiner being a meathead? John, I would point out that your favorite movie, Groundhog Day, gets mentioned, Bill Murray's in 48th place. Victor, Henry Fonda, Grapes of Wrath, came in at 51st. This is all according to a recent American media study. And then HR, 82nd place, George T. Scott for Patton. So, John, greatest single cinematic performance.
Maybe Rob Reiner is being modest because he didn't put in The Princess Bride.
You fool! You fell victim to one of the classic blunders! The most famous is never get involved in a land war in Asia.
HR?
Hey, well, you know, it's hard for me to come up with one, with just one, but I'll tell you, you can't go wrong with Brando. Brando's just so darn good, you know, I think. So I would say just Brando overall across multiple movies. And then just to be maybe funny about it, how about Donald Sutherland as Oddball? You know, in Kelly's Heroes, when he says, you know, a tank can give you a nice edge.
A Sherman can give you a very nice edge.
Victor, I mentioned Henry Fonda, Grapes of Wrath, because I wanted to peel the farmer in you. But yeah. do you have a favorite actor in film?
Oh, that was a great performance. Jimmy Stewart, all that generation. And Gregory Peck and Kill a Mockingbird was great. But I think George C. Scott he became Patton. So that was a great, I don't think that role, Marlon Brando was great on, that was his greatest role on The Waterfront, but George C. Scott I'd go with.
You goddamn coward!
Okay. My choice goes to an actor named John Vernon, who stars in a movie called Animal House, which at all times is a font of wisdom. He is Dean Wormer, and of course he's the one who said fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life.
Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
I can argue there are a few things more profound than that.
And we left out actors of the female gender here, too, of which there are many excellent ones.
Yes, good point. Okay, we have a final question for viewer mail, which is a reminder that we do welcome questions from our audience. If you want to pose a question to John H.R. Neal, you go to hoover.org/askgoodfellows. That site again is hoover.org/askgoodfellows. Our question this week comes from Spencer in London, England, who writes, for the applied historians, can you review historical cases in which countries grew as divided as we are today and then came back together, teaching us about how they did so? Reading Tom Holland's Roman History trilogy recently made me think Trump and Biden were a worryingly good Sulla and Marius comparison. Maybe since Clinton's impeachment or since Robert Bork, the game seems to be tit and a half for tit down to hell. Victor, are we currently living something similar to the Roman Civil War of the first century BC?
I hope not, because the solution that brought people together was Augustus, who ended the Republic. And I hope we're not at that point. And the French Revolution was ended by Napoleon, and the Weimar chaos was ended by Hitler. So we don't want that to happen. And we have to show a lot more self-restraint. But it's getting very scary because it's a geographical force multiplier now. In our federal system, people are moving to areas where they feel comfortable, and the red paradigm's working, the blue one's failing, but they're dividing. And so I can see it in my own family. I mean, people, siblings that don't speak to me. So it's scary.
John, can you think of a country that managed to work out its differences?
Yeah, I've been trying hard. Now, yes, many instances, but usually when they come together over over an external threat. You know, the U.S. was pretty divided in 1939, and we all came together in 1941. And so, you know, thanks to the Japanese, but I'd like to not do it that way. Of course, the U.S. was also pretty divided in the 1850s, and we came together at another great cost in life. I'd like to not do it that way either. And I'm especially finding it difficult to find a case where the problem has been the political takeover and the rot of the institutions, the norms, the restraints, the don't bring a gun to a knife fight kind of approach, where people cared about keeping the institutions of the country going. And now, as I think we've said several times on the show, watching the institutions of the country become politicized, as well as just the opinions of people, is a very dangerous moment. So I'm not the historian, and I can't think of one where that all resolved peacefully, but I'm hoping one of you guys can.
Let's go to a historian, H.R. Sott. Can you give us an example of a divided country that came together?
Well, there are many examples, but I'm trying to think of examples that didn't involve a great deal of violence, right? And then people coming together after they had looked over or experienced, you know, the falling off the precipice of disaster. So I think maybe a useful examples are some of the ones that John just mentioned, are the leaders who brought together a country that had become increasingly divided, right? And emphasized our common identity. I think there are great examples in American history. I mean, beginning with George Washington. I mean, it was not an easy task, obviously, to bring the country together, who had identified mainly as individual colonies and then individual states under any kind of federal authority. The revision of the form of government into the Constitution took leadership. Obviously, you know, after the Civil War, it was very difficult to bring the country together. That accommodation happened largely at the expense of Black Americans. It was accommodation mainly between Northern whites and Southern whites. We struggled with that through the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, America's always been a work in progress. I think of the Reagan era as a period in which we regained our confidence. So I think, you know, just to maybe not to answer your question, but a different one, Bill, is, you know, look at examples when we've had leaders who have brought Americans together. We've always been divided, right? Divisions aren't new. It's really the degree to which we're confident in our leadership, and as we've talked about here today, in our institutions, such that we have a say in how we're governed, that we do enjoy the rule of law. We have to restore our confidence. A lot of that has to do with what we've talked a lot about in this program. Maybe we can have Victor back to talk about this, which is, you know, the curriculum of self-loathing in our institutions that teach our young people that our country may not even be worth defending. You know, so I really think there's so much to work on, but let's get after it. Let's work on it.
I just want to salute our resident optimist for closing on the right note. And you've also convinced me you're right. You know, let's think about Reagan and Thatcher. Now, yes, they were hated by the left at their time, but they did bring back growth, confidence, competent institutions. So by the mid-1990s, they had, you know, the countries were in fact grudgingly back together, even though the left wouldn't admit it was thanks to Reagan. I think of, you know, Harding and Coolidge in the 1920s. Our country was in pretty bad shape in the after Wilson got done with it, and you know, they brought back by bringing the institutions together, returned to normalcy. The country was healed in many ways. So yes, thank you, HR. It's possible, and you're giving me some hope.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you for ending on an optimistic note. Victor, thanks ever so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Good luck with the harvest and good luck for the book. Its title, again, for our listeners, is The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. On behalf of my colleagues, H.R. McMaster, John Cochran, Victor Davis Hanson, the absent Neil Ferguson, who we hope is safe and sound wherever the international man of history happens to be right now, we hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please send in your comments, send in your questions. We look forward to being back soon with a new episode. Until then, you take care. We'll see you soon.
If you enjoyed this show and are interested in listening to more content featuring H.R. McMaster, subscribe to Battlegrounds, also available at hoover.org/battlegrounds.